So we've all had moments where we have led with fear. We've threatened an athlete that if they didn't start working hard, we were going to make them run. Or we shamed an athlete by calling them out in front of their teammates, questioning their character, their toughness. Or maybe we've just used an authoritarian and controlling style leadership just to get our athletes to do what we want them to do. Yet we know the more we lead with fear, the more we are missing out on the wonderful opportunities that sport create to build character, resilience, and mental toughness. Now, our guest for the next two episodes is Steve Magnus, who is a world-renowned expert on performance. He's the author of the new book, Do Hard Things, Why We Get Resilience Wrong, and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness. I can't recommend this one enough. He's also the co-author of Peak Performance, The Passion Paradox, and the author of The Science of Running. Collectively, his books have sold more than 500,000 copies in print, ebook, and audio formats. Magnus has also served as an executive coach to individuals in a variety of sectors. His work serves on applying the principles of which he writes about. And in addition, he's served as a consultant on mental skills development for professional sports teams. In his most recent book, though, Do Hard Things, he makes the best argument I've come across in any book on why fear-based coaching in sports needs to end right now. And in today's episode, we're going to unpack that a little bit and how fear-based coaching is harmful and goes against our long-term goals as a coach. In part two of our conversation, we'll be unpacking with him how to build mentally tough and confident athletes. And I'll be honest, I got super excited to have this conversation with Steve, which I think you'll sense in the interviews as I talk super, super fast at different moments. But I think this is one of those episodes that you're going to be re-listening to and sharing with others. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. If you're a new listener, welcome. My name is JP Nerman. I'm the founder of this podcast, the author of the book, The Culture System, A Proven Process for Creating an Extraordinary Team Culture, and the founder of TOC, which provides online courses and one-on-one coaching for coaches. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. The mission of this podcast is to help leaders grow and build better team cultures. Don't forget, you do not need to take notes, all right? Just subscribe to our weekly newsletter to get the notes to this and every episode of the Coaching Culture Podcast. It's free, and you can do that at tocculture.com. Also, when you sign up there, you'll get a free chapter of my book, The Culture System, which part four of that book goes deep into ways to better support and enforce behavioral standards within our team to hold people accountable in a way that is highly demanding but not demeaning. Which is so much of what our conversation is about today with Steve. So let's get right into our conversation with Steve Magnus.
Well, Steve, it's great to have you on the podcast. We're going to dive into a few different topics that are related to your latest book here, but I want to do a little bit of just kind of a broad background on two questions that's going to kind of set the stage for the line of questioning that JP is going to have for you here in a few minutes. The first one is, broadly speaking, when you look at parenting styles and coaching styles and leadership styles and our response to stress, I think has become stress is bad. Stay away from stress. Protect your children, right? At all costs, keep them from adversity. We don't want them to be harmed. We want them to be safe. What's your response to that sort of line of thinking that's become more and more dominant here in terms of just what are we getting wrong about stress?
So that's a great question. And I think we have a fundamental kind of misunderstanding of stress and that it is, we see it as this negative thing, but stress is what leads to adaptation. It's what leads to growth. Like we know this from an athletic standpoint. If we step back and we say, oh, I want to get, you know, a muscle stronger, what do? We apply a stress, which go in the weight room, lift some heavy weights that, you know, stress your body and are get to the point of fatigue, and then you rest, recover, and your body grows and adapts. So you adapt to that stress. Well, in many ways, it's the same in terms of other forms of stress, psychological stress, emotional stress, is that they provide a avenue or a room for adaptation if we allow them to. So the answer isn't to avoid. That's like going in and saying, you know what? Lifting those weights makes you feel really tired and fatigued. and tiredness is bad. So we're just going to avoid feeling tired and try and feel great all the time. Well, if that's your goal, you never grow stronger. You know, never adapt. And the same thing occurs with other stresses. So for example, if I always avoid or shy away from something difficult, maybe it's, you know, speaking up in front of a room or public speaking or, you know, whatever, taking some sort of risk. What happens is my brain kind of goes, oh, okay, like stress is bad, stress is negative. These are things that I'm going to avoid. So if I'm in this situation, you know, again, I'm going to turn that alarm to 10. I'm going to go up, get out of here. Public speaking is bad. I never want to do that. Well, we know through decades of research, psychology, it's very basic, is if we want to get better, if we want to adapt, we have to kind of, you know, inoculate ourselves a little bit, like not do something overwhelming, but kind of go towards the discomfort so that we can kind of make it a friend.
And I think for a lot of our coaches, that's a challenge, right? Because we're trying to get our players to embrace the discomfort of playing a difficult schedule or learning a new skill or pushing ourselves beyond our, you know, perceived limits. And yet, you know, there's this feeling of, you know, not just in our kids, but even in parents sometimes that there's a fear that they're fragile, right? And that, you know, are we going to push them too hard? Are they going to be ready for that? And so the parent intervenes or, you know, whatever the situation might be. So for the adults in the room, you know, encouraging those that are leading young people, like what's the encouragement there in terms of trying to prepare our players, our students, our own kids for being able to face some of those stressors that are necessary for growth?
You know, I think it's really about creating the environment and giving kids the space to take on those challenges and potentially fail. And this is where we often get it wrong, as we say, oh, okay, like stress is good, so I'm going to go, you know, challenge my kid or my athlete or whatever have you. And what happens is we challenge them, but then we have like these crazy consequences, or we get angry and mad and like upset at our kid after he loses the soccer game or what have you. And then we instill this like fear of failure so that they learn not to take on the challenge, but instead be like, okay, stress might be good, but if I lose this game, my mom or dad are going to lecture me on the car ride home for 30 minutes. So I'm just going to avoid giving the effort or avoid this situation. So what we really want to do is create the environment where it allows people to take risks. It allows kids to venture outside of their comfort zone. It allows kids to, you know, embrace some sort of stress and even some sort of anxiety so that they adapt to it. And if we do that, like, yeah, sometimes they're going to fail. But what happens is they find out kind of what they're capable of and where they can grow, versus if we always step in, they don't learn. And I'm going to take you way outside of sport for a little bit. My wife is elementary school teacher, so I get to learn way more about, you know, teaching kids how to read than I ever thought I would know. But there was a fascinating study that showed that when you're teaching kids how to read or basic math, if a tutor steps in, or a teacher or tutor steps in immediately when someone is struggling, learning doesn't take place. If they wait a little bit and you say, you know what, little Johnny or Susie, like just kind of try and figure out this math problem and like mess around with it. Even if you get it wrong, it's okay. If you give them just a little bit of that space to wrestle with it, even if they end up wrong, and then you offer guidance and coaching, they actually learn. Like the learning goes up, whatever, several fold. So I kind of look at that model in the same way for when we're coaching or when we're trying to get athletes to, you know, take on challenges, is sometimes we need to kind of let them, give them the space to struggle a little bit, and then, you know, come in with coaching, correcting, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I know we'll get into this a little bit, but it just reminds me, we played a game last night against the seventh ranked team in a class that's one class bigger than ours, and thought we'd be able to compete, got beat by 20. And so I'm talking to one of my captains on the way home on the bus ride. And we're talking about, you know, what should we do in film today, this afternoon? And she said, I just don't know if we should really even look at this game, because we should probably just move on. And, you know, just, I don't know, not, you know, and just like this aversion to that feeling of embarrassment and, you know, not playing as well as we thought we could. And And I think what you're onto here is like, it's about the learning, right? And that's what I told Cam. I said, Cam, honestly, I couldn't care less about the outcome of the game, but what the game offers us both in success and failure is the opportunity for growth. And that's what I'm most interested in. So what do I show from the film that, you know, can accentuate that growth, trying to build that growth mindset around, you know, positive and negative experiences, but there's value there if we can sort of give them the right frame of reference.
Exactly. And I think this is where game film, I love game film, even though I come from a track background where we don't really watch game film much, but I love it because it gives this opportunity, right? Where you can learn and grow, or like athletes see it as like this negative, and I'm sure you've experienced this. I've experienced this with actually basketball players I've worked with, where they're like, oh no, I don't want to watch the game film because it gives them so much anxiety. Right? They're like, we lost. I played horrible. I don't want to watch where I messed up. And that gives the perfect avenue where we're like, okay, how do we create the environment? How do we frame things? Not as like, hey, we're going to watch all the stuff you sucked at and you're going to feel like a horrible player, but as a way to like, okay, here's some stuff we did right. Here's some stuff maybe we did wrong. What can we learn from this? How do we grow from this? And it's this perfect avenue. And actually, you know, there was a research study that I covered in the book a little bit where a sports psychologist used watching the worst moments of these. I think it was Olympic level swimmers, the worst moments of Olympic level swimmers. He kind of said, hey, we get it. It sucks to look back on this, to lose, to feel this anxiety, but we're going to like bring that alarm down by just kind of watching it, observing it, and not assigning like this huge negative meaning to this stress, and like allow you to kind of deal with it. And what they found is that it increased their resilience and allowed them to kind of come to terms with some really bad races that they had, so that they could then move forward and not see that failure as like this big, you know, self-defining thing.
Well, I know JP's got an axe to grind here when it comes to old school coaching, but I want to ask one more question just to set the stage for that. One of the things that I think is most impressive just listening to you on podcasts and reading your work is that it seems that your philosophy and your approaches start from the research. And I was thinking about doing a little pool with JP here about how many seconds it would be before you use the word research or studies, you know, in the interview today. But I think in coaching, especially and probably parenting too, so much of our approach is drawn from our own experience or what we see on the movies or, you know, what traditional coaching has been. And I guess for those that, you know, maybe we have a lot of high school coaches that listen to the podcast that aren't reading, you know, dozens of studies during the season or in the off season, why is it so important to start with the research rather than the anecdote when it comes to really trying to discover the best approaches to coaching and working with our young people?
Oh man. So my confession is I'm like a science nerd at heart. So, but I really believe it's in the blend. So often you get like these extremes of like, oh, I don't want to pay attention to any research, or like you need it to have all. And I'm about marrying the two. So when I see really good coaches do something, and then I read some research and some studies that basically say the same thing, I'm like, okay, this is the gold. Because we have like real world experience plus like scientific background and data that shows that this is on it. And you don't need to spend all, I'm going to give people a quote unquote hack. You don't need to spend all day looking at research. Follow the right people on social media who tweet things out or share things on Instagram, who will give you the synopsis of like the latest stuff, because people who are in that field, you know, are excited to share what they're learning. And if you follow the right people, you're going to get, you know, 90% of the work without having to bore yourself to death reading the research because someone else has done the work. But I think it's really important to have both, because for the simple reason is it's very easy for us to fool ourselves. So if we see one anecdote or we see one coach who had success and he tells us to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And then we're like, oh, this is the key. We're going to do this. Well, he might be successful because he did X, Y, and Z, but it could be because, you know, he just happened to get, you know, the best five talented people show up in his, you know, freshman class, and they did, they're going to be good no matter if we do crazy stuff or if we do great stuff, because sometimes like extreme talent can show that way, especially in high school. So that's why I, it's really important to have some sort of mechanism to kind of like counterbalance that, that, you know, human ability to kind of fool ourselves into whatever story we want to tell.
Steve, I'm going to tell you a quick story here. I'll be honest with you. I was getting all, the algorithm was giving me your book as the book I needed to buy on Amazon for a long time. And I was like, I had just done David Goggins's books. And I'm like, all right, I all this do hard stuff. Like I've got enough of that motivation. I was about to run an ultra marathon, a big one back in September. And I fought the algorithm until I'd run my ultra. And then I started looking through kind of the reviews, and your book had a glowing reviews, loads of five stars, but I love looking at the one star reviews, because it's always like, what did this book, you know, like do to piss someone off? Right. And it was, you know, something, someone had said something about all this soft coaching and softness and all this. And I was like, oh, this is great. And I clicked and I bought it. Right. So that got me right there. As soon as I read like the one star review, I was fully committed to reading this book. But I'll tell you, man, like from the second I started reading, and I was actually listening to it at first, I was just like, this is it. This is finally the book that really lays out the argument for how old school coaching, aggressive shaming, all that type of stuff, how that just got, that has to be gone. That has to be just completely removed from sports today. Just like it just doesn't fly in the business world anymore, right? Like the CEO chewing everybody out, like that doesn't fly. But my question to start us off today is, what type of resistance or arguments have you started to get from coaches that have maybe read the book so far? Like, cause I'm sure since you published the book, you've been going out there and you've been talking, like what's some of the resistance, the arguments against your argument that you've received?
Oh man, JP, that's a great question. One that I haven't gotten yet. So, you know, what it is this, is that I think the resistance that I've gotten is anytime you try and change a paradigm a little bit, it gets at something that people are comfortable with. So the resistance I've gotten from coaches are like, yeah, I agree. We need to like swing a little bit this way, but like this actually worked. You know, for example, I kind of talk about Bobby Knight in the book, and so many basketball coaches have been like, yeah, that all that's true. We shouldn't hit players like Bobby Knight, whatever. But, you know, before he got into that trouble, like, he won national championship games and he won a ton of games. And they're right. Like he did win a lot of games. And what I like to say is the answer to some of that is, look, you got to understand that with good coaches who win a lot of games, it's not that 100% of what they're doing works. It's that they've gotten a majority of it, maybe like 70% of it right. But we don't know the difference between the 70% that worked and the 30% that like probably was trash and backfired, but they could get away with it because they had the 70%. And again, I'm not a basketball guy, but using Bobby Knight as example, talking to guys in the NBA and college, they said it was pretty clear. Bobby Knight was like a genius at defense and tactically and all that stuff and schemes, all that stuff. That's probably what got him most of the games. And then the other thing that is important in looking at some of this old school dynamics is it also worked because the culture was completely different. So using the college example, pretty simple, is again, during the Bobby Knight era, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, you couldn't just sign up for a transfer portal. You couldn't, it wasn't easy to talk to your friends at the, you know, neighboring schools over social media or even text or what have you to understand what it was like. The power dynamics were so shifted that often it was a case of, well, I survive this coaching or I don't know what my options are, right? And what that does is it gives an inordinate amount of power and leeway to the coach so that the old school style can quote unquote work. Because like these athletes don't have any power or options. And this is often why if you look at, and it's the same in high school, right? High school, it used to be you show up to gym class and you want to play basketball. You got whatever coach is there and you stuck whatever. Now there's more options. And now there's more accountability in the sense that, like, you know, mom and dad are going to know, or it's going to find out on social media or what have you. So you can't take the, what I'd call the cheap and easy way to authority. Like, you actually have to do the work to gain trust and, like, be authentic and realize that, you know, the athletes have some voice and choice in this coaching dynamic now.
And some of that shift towards the power being with the athlete isn't all positive in sports today, but I think this, in this area, it is, I think choice in many ways is a good thing. You know, if you create a positive experience, you build relationships, players are more likely, you know, the ones you really want to stay are, you know, they're more likely to stay, not in all cases, right? But I think that that's really great what you shared there. I'd also add, this is what I hear a lot, and I'm curious how you, what you would say to this. What I hear a lot when I'm talking with coaches around this is, yeah, you know, it really comes down to, you got to know your players, and like, some guys or some girls, they can take it, you know, like, and that's what they need. They need hard coaching. In fact, not only do I hear this from coaches, but some of my coaches hear this from players. Like, coach, I need you to get into me. I need you to lay me out. Like, I need you to coach me hard. Like, that's the only way to get me motivated. So what do you say to those coaches and to those players?
Yeah, this is kind of what I'd call the Michael Jordan criticism, right? Because Michael Jordan is like, he would create in his own head, like, you know, all this motivation through slights, right? It's like the classic Michael Jordan story. Like, you know, I got cut from my high school basketball team, or got put on GAV or whatever. And if my favorite is, if you look at his Hall of Fame speech, it's all like telling people, you know, you all doubted me. And in my head, I'm like, dude, you're the greatest, like the greatest ever. Like, sure, some people doubted you, but most people thought you were going to be great. But that's kind of the other side of that critique. It's like, well, some people need that. Well, first of all, very few of us are Michael Jordan and are wired that way. Most people, you know, aren't. And we know this, again, not to go back to the research, but the research shows that overwhelmingly, if you want to cultivate what we call intrinsic motivation, which is the good kind of motivation, because it comes from inside and is not focused on just shiny objects and, you know, winning medals or money or what have you, is that treating people like a decent human being is how you get there. Now, some people, right, they might need a little bit more of either extrinsic motivation or a little poking and prodding or what have you, but it's often not as much as we kind of see. And the other thing that I would say to that critique is, you got to look at that person's background. So if the only way that this athlete was coached was through like that poking, prodding, pushing, like yelling at them, then that is often, they think, oh, this is the only way I can get motivated. I need this. And I had this actually when I was a college coach. I had one athlete come in and be like, you know, his high school coach threw rocks at him sometimes while they were racing. And you're just like, rocks? But he came to me, is like, I need you to be like, you know, get on me and yell and scream and cuss and stuff like that. And I said, okay, like, we can try some of that, but like, give me a shot and let's try motivating you in a variety of ways. And what happened is, it took some time, but after a year or two, like, he was like, no, I have a much greater, you know, relationship with this sport than I did like with the old kind of fear-based. I just didn't know it, right? So what I would say is, don't, if you're hesitant about this, if you have a player who you think, hey, needs to be ridden hard, like, don't just switch your styles completely, like, gradually change and introduce some new motivational styles and tactics and see if that player adapts. And I'm going to bet 9 times out of 10 that he or she does.
Yeah. Especially when we make those changes, or if we step into a new job, you know, we transfer, like, it can be a shock the way that we're coaching. And I've learned that early on. Like, as I started to make changes back in 2015, 16, it was with a team. They got to experience my growth and change, and they knew that it was something I was working on. I explained why I was trying to not yell and scream and all that stuff anymore, and try to be more in control and try to intrinsically motivate them. Then you flash forward, and I'm coaching a pro team, you know, during the COVID pandemic here in Ireland where I live, and they're like, we need you to get on us. Like, and I'm like, well, that's just not my style. But I recognized they had gone through, I mean, some of these were women that are 30 years old. And I'm like, you still need me to get on you? And they're like, but that's always that's the coaching they've always had. And so I had to, within my value system, I think, start to be a little bit more coach led, be a little bit more, you know, pull dust off the old crazy, you know, fired up JP and, you know, bring him out in the sidelines occasionally, like to, because that's what my players needed, knowing that, hey, this isn't always going to be the case, and to start to slow drip that. So I absolutely love what you're sharing there. I think it's huge. Here's a good question for you. I played for one of the most transactional coaches I know out there when it comes to this type of yelling and screaming and kind of demeaning the players. And I hated it. I was miserable. All my motivation, I love the game of basketball. All my motivation was gone. By the time I left high school, it was all gone. But yet I started, not that I was ever at his level, but I still fell back into that trap. That was the way I was going to coach him. Why is this so common? Like, why, you know, our experience is negative, but then we go on to just, do you have any, and in your experience and your research, have you come across why this is, you know, continually justified or, you know, just continued behavior?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's because that's our learned behavior. So here, I think it, if you look at the research in parenting, it kind of gives you some, you know, good insight, is that often we look at, you know, parenting styles, and there's a higher likelihood if you were parented in, let's say, an authoritarian style, that you're going to adopt the same style. Even if you're one, if as a kid you were like, oh man, my parents, you know, did X, Y, and Z, and I can't believe they locked my windows or whatever it is, like, you know, wouldn't let me do stuff. Like, you're more likelihood, it's not a guarantee, but you're more likely to parent in the same style that your parents did. And the reason is pretty simple, is because it's our default. We when we're in that moment and we're not sure quite what to do, like in parenting, or like when we start coaching, because, you know, we played as an athlete, but it's not like you go into a full internship in coaching where you're just like, this is how you learn to do it, right? A lot of times you just got to get thrown into the wolves and you're just like, okay, I got to figure this out with whatever, you know, a bunch of teenagers or early adults like staring back at me looking for guidance. So what do we do in those moments? We default to what we've seen, what we know, what's comfortable. So if we've coached in that style, then we're more likely to continue coaching in that style. It's kind of like the, it's almost like we get in a rut because that rut is so well worn and grooved and we know it. And even if we know, hey, this might not be optimal, it's familiar. So during times of stress, we go back to that familiar. And when we're learning our own coaching, it's stressful. So it you know, the message I'd give to coaches out there is, any sort of change is going to feel uncomfortable, but just like we talked about with kids, you know, where you have to embrace that discomfort to grow, it's the same as coaches. If you're sitting here listening and being like, oh man, but like these players, they need this, and this feels a little soft and wishy-washy over here doing this. Well, just, you don't have to dive right in. Just like gradually take that step over there, embrace that discomfort and see what happens.
Absolutely. I know some coaches listen to this and they go, okay, well, what are we supposed to do? Just, you know, be permissive, let them get away with, you know, crappy effort or bad attitudes, you know? So let's talk about that. Like, what's the alternative? What's the better way of doing things than just letting them off the hook when they're not giving great effort in practice? Let's just start with something that's that simple. The effort stinks in whatever sport it is. If I can't yell, scream, or make them get on the line and, you know, run or do 100 pushups, then what do I do?
Yeah. So this is where you go talk to a track or cross country coach. And I say that in jest, but think about it like this. Okay. So I coached track and cross country for a long time, distance runners. If an athlete isn't giving effort, what am I going to make them do? Their workout, their sport is literally working out. They are already running, you know, laps or intervals or something that is going to complete exhaustion on the track, because like, that is how you get better. So you can't use a lot of these old school tactics there because like the punishment is the thing that is their sport. So what you quickly have to learn is like, okay, if someone's not giving effort, then I need to A, get to the bottom of why this is the case, right? Is it because, you know, something is going on in their life and they're distracted or they've got, you know, these stresses outside? Is it because, you know, they aren't giving effort because they're kind of fearing failure and they're afraid of like, hey, what happens if I try? Right. The example I like to give here is the one we've all used in school where we're just like, okay, if I don't study for a test and I do poorly, then I can say, you know what, I didn't study for it. So that doesn't really reflect my effort or my grade or what have you. Like, it's not a big deal. So we intentionally self-sabotage. Often athletes do the same thing. They're like afraid to risk and see how good they are. So they self-sabotage. They don't give the effort. So getting to know your players and understanding where they're kind of coming from. And the other part is, okay, if you say, all right, we figured it out. Then the other part of it to me is with that effort piece is like establishing trust in making the importance of the effort, not the result. So often kids will stop giving effort because the result isn't there. And you learn this again in track really quickly. You know, if I say go run a lap in 70 seconds and they run it in 75, their effort will go down. Why? Because they think they failed. But me as a coach, my job in that moment is to be like, okay, throw out the stopwatch, forget about making the buckets, whatever have you. The effort is all that matters in this moment. That's all that we care about. So results, forget it. I want you to stay focused, give this effort here. And often like shifting that mindset frees them up to, you know, show up on time and give the effort as well.
That is phenomenal stuff because I love that, you know, throw out the stopwatch because that's a lot of times what we got to do as coaches, right? Like if you've got a soccer drill and you're trying to work on spacing or whatever attacking, it's like the effort stinks. Well, you got to start with great effort to actually get better at the actual skill that you want to, because you can't train in at 75% and really expect to get that much better, right? At certain things, the same in basketball. Like if you're just, you want to have great effort to learn these skills in a competitive environment. And I think that's a great reminder, is focus on that. I think the other thing too, that people miss so often is character, like work ethic. Like it's a skill, like, but for some reason, we as coaches go, yeah, I'll teach him how to shoot a better jump shot. I'll teach him how to run the pick and roll. I'll teach him how to do this. But when his effort's not great, oh, like you know, like I can't coach that. Like there's that phrase, I can't coach effort. It's like, but effort and work ethic, that's a skill. Like our job is teachers. We're supposed to be working with them on this, right?
Exactly. And this is the thing. It's all, you know, it's all a skill. Is, you know, again, if you think about it, if someone hasn't learned work ethic or dedication or whatever have you, or even how to be on time, like we can yell and scream at them and say, hey, this sucks. But if they've never had that experience, then that skill is like, you know, whatever, kindergarten level. It's on us to develop that. So often, again, this is why I say treat people like people is, you know, in your new job, we've all had experience, we start a new job and we inevitably mess something up, right? Maybe we didn't respond to some emails or fill out some paperwork, right? If our boss came in and laid into us the first time, what would our response be? We'd like shrink away. We'd be like, this sucks. Like, forget this guy. Like, I'm going to try, but only because I'm going to try because I don't want to get yelled at. But if our boss comes in and says, hey, I realize you didn't fill out this spreadsheet or you didn't do it this the right way, let me teach you how to do this and why this is important, then we're more likely to be okay, thanks, like this is important, this I didn't know it was important, now I do, like this is how I do this. And we get taught that skill that then carries forward. And I think it's the same on the athletic standpoint, is like if someone consistently shows up late, the thing to do isn't initially go straight to go run laps. It's to pull them aside, have a conversation, understand why they're late, and then tell them it's really important. you know, for X, Y, and Z reasons that you show up on time because like this allows us to get the proper warm-up in so you're not injured, or it respects your teammates, you know, time and all these things, whatever your reasons are, but make it clear as day first. And then if it continues not to happen, then you start going down the steps of interventions and tools to correct it.
Yeah. And let's just pull a little bit more on that thread there. One of the things I love about your book is how you know, you talk about business, you talk about parenting, you talk about the classroom and in sports as well. And I feel like the majority of the tools that I have learned over the years that I share with coaches that I write about in my book come from the work of people that do a lot of work in education and parenting, because when we yell at our kids, like we don't feel good about it. And we also don't want to have to yell at them all the time to do their chores, right? Like it just doesn't make sense. And so we've had people like Dr. Jane Nelson from Positive Discipline on this podcast, because I think they're well ahead of us in coaching. I mean, the reality is like, if I yelled at my students, like I yelled at my players years ago, I would have been out of a job so quick, you know? But end of the day, there has to be consequences. Like, you know, we try the support. You know, what are some, in your eyes, some good, appropriate type consequence type things that you coaches should be using when players continuously show up late or continuously, hey, you've tried to help them, you've tried to identify that, and they're just making more of a conscious choice to not give that effort?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I think it really depends on the team, the sport, and the individuals. But most of my, you know, consequences that I like to use are it's again, knowing the individual, but understanding why they're motivated is really important, and understanding kind of the status around the sport. So I like to use consequences that show like, hey, you're letting down other parts of this team, this organization, or what have you. So often I like to cover it as like, hey, you know, your teammates, you're letting down your teammates are going to decide like what the consequences are. And again, I use this in college, like, what do you think it is? And sometimes they'll be like, hey, you have to not show up to practice, or you have to do this on your own, or like, you don't get coach's attention. Like the other ones that I like to use there for consequences, if someone shows up late, for example, and isn't doing anything right, I'm going to be like, hey, I have to pay attention to the people who showed up on time, who are thoroughly warmed up, who are ready to go, who are giving the effort and focus. So I'm going to go over here and coach. Like, I need you to go through everything, and you're not going to, like, today I can't correct you or give the coach or give the attention because like, you're not ready to go yet. Right. And you might think like, oh, well, that's not really a consequences, but what you're doing is you're taking them outside of the group. And if you look at from teens to adults, when you get outside of the group, like it's a natural consequence because it's like, oh, I'm a little isolated, not like intentionally, but I'm a little isolated. I'm a little out of the normal flow of things. I want to be in that group. I want to be part of the crew that's doing things right. And you're doing it in a way that is like logical too. It's like, there's a reason behind it that you can explain.
I love that one. Like the loss of coaching, because coaching is a privilege. And I think so often when we go to, well, you're not working hard, so now I'm going to make you run or I'm going to yell at you. Like it seems like, well, it's something I've got to do. And we talk a lot about like, we want to retrain their mind. It's like, I get coaching from Coach Steve, right? I get to come in here and work on my stuff. And so we talk about a lot about loss of privilege. Like, hey, you're not going to work hard, you can just step off, you know, like we'll see you in the next drill. Like, and that really starts to retrain back to what you talked about, that intrinsic motivation is where they start to see, oh, practice is supposed to be good for me. Like I want to get better. Like this is in line with my goals, right? So I think that's awesome. I love one of the stories you share in the book. I think it's a teacher named Hillary, and she uses in the classroom like a reset. Now, a reset could be almost like a positive timeout where she has to step off. I just love that one. I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I thought that was a brilliant example of the athlete, if it was used with an athlete, still maintaining autonomy, which is you talk about so important to intrinsic motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of my favorite stories, and it was actually from my wife, who is named Hillary. So
oh, there we go.
it was great. And, you know, the reason I got to understand this is it was during the pandemic. So I got to see both online and then in person, helping her out a little bit on some of these things. But it was great because, again, you mentioned it, but one of the best things you can do as coach is go observe education. Because teachers, like if a player messes up, whatever, we could yell or we could do punish. But when you've got a bunch of, I don't know, screaming seven-year-olds, and you lose control of your class, it's chaos. So you have to figure out what actually works. And what she put it like this is that when a kid messes up, doesn't, you know, automatically go to the punishment, but she wants to maintain some sort of autonomy. So what do? When you mess up or you're in trouble or like you're doing things wrong, often you're in a heightened emotional state. So she says, you know what? You need to like reset, which essentially is kind of a positive timeout. Like, hey, let things settle down a little bit. Like you can reset at your desk, just take a quiet moment. You can go, you know, sit in the chair in the corner of the room and just calm down a little bit, wherever, whatever. Just take a moment, like count to 10 or 20 or whatever it is, and like let that emotion come down. And then she'll say, I'm going to give you a choice, right? Thanks for resetting. You can, in coaching language, you can either, you know, join in on the drill now, or, you know, the other option, you know, her option for kids is, or, you know, we can work on it at recess, which means, you know, they're kind of getting a punishment, quote unquote, because they want to do recess, but they're working on something on like how to handle conflict, for example, or how to handle, you know, interacting with a student. We can do the same thing, you know, in our style. So for coaching, it's like, you can either reset and join in with the group and, you know, give the effort for the drill, or after practice, you know, we can work on X, Y, and Z X, Y, and Z thing that is related to why you, you know, didn't give the effort needed or the performance that we were needed or whatever have you, or did the drill, you know, incorrectly where you weren't paying attention to, whatever it is. You give them that option, which provides them a little autonomy instead of seeing it as like a dictatorship where it's like, hey, I'm in charge, you're in trouble, here's your punishment, do this.
Yeah, and I love that because your wife is working with the students to equip them with how to even, especially like, you know, discipline can often be an emotional thing, which, you know, dysregulates an individual. And so, or just they're already in a, like in sports, they're in a stressful environment, right? Like a athlete's not hustling, they're not playing well, which is the cause of their effort to drop within the game. And we want to pull them out and rip them when they're already dysregulated. And here it's like, well, there has to be a consequence. You're not giving great effort, but it's like, we're trying to work with the athletes or our kids. Like, you know, we used a lot with my own children. It's like teaching them like, hey, there's a routine and trying to establish routines for that positive timeout in their room when they're fighting with their brother and sister, you know, that type of stuff. So, it comes back to this choice. Like you have a choice, And I love that stuff. All right. So we're going to take a break in the conversation. We'll be back next episode with more from Steve and to get into the finer details of how he builds mental toughness in athletes and how we can boost their confidence, which I know so many athletes struggle with confidence and mental toughness. I don't think I have had a conversation with a coach in quite some time that really described their team as like really mentally tough, or there wasn't a bunch of the players that said, hey, you know, I don't have a confidence issue. Like there's so many players that struggle with confidence and teams that struggle with that mental toughness. In the meantime, be sure to pick up Steve's book, Do Hard Things. And if you haven't already, go ahead and throw my book in your Amazon cart as well, The Culture System. So much synergy between the ideas that Steve and I share.